Welcome again, everybody. It's actually welcome back. We've had an extra week, so 3 weeks off. This week, this is Rabbi Hartstock again. Thank you. Next week's Rabbi Adler. The week after is Dr. Becker. The week after that is Rabbi Yehuda Halpert. Then Yontif. And the 28th, before Yom Kippur, is Shua Katz. So thank you again, Rabbi Hartstock. And without further ado.
Okay. Erev Tov, thank you, Harry. Thank you all very much for the opportunity. So what I'd like to do is focus. This is a Parshat Shoftim. At the end of Parshat Shoftim is the unusual Parsha of the Egla Arufa. What I'd like to do is spend some time on that, focusing. I can spend a little time in the Chumash. I want to use these sources. So on the source sheet, there are three questions, basically what I'd like to focus on. The first, those are the three things in bold. The first is, what is it? It's what's the idea of this mitzvah. The second is, why is it here? Specifically to focus on its placement and location, what there is to learn from that in terms of where it falls in the context of the parashot that they were learning and that we're reading right now. And third is, what is its message in terms of the overarching message? So those are the three things that I want to deal with. And I would start with just reading the psukim inside, just to remind ourselves and kind of get the vibe of this parsha. So it's Perek Kaf Aleph in Sefer Dvarim, Parashat Shoftim, at page 1042, and it is a unit that goes 9 psukim. We'll just kind of read it through again, just to get the circumstances, and then we'll start to dig a little bit in it. So the Torah describes Pascal in Perek Kaf Aleph ki imatzei chalal ba'adama asher Hashem Elokecha nitein lecha l'rishta nofel ba'sadeh lo noda miyikau. The circumstance is that discover a halal, a corpse, a dead body. It's not, basadeh means it's not inhabited, it's not clear, it's kind of not part of a city, so it's open field, literally, and they don't know who caused this to happen. First is to figure out how to determine who's responsible, not like who's guilty, but who has to take responsibility for the body, so they measure who's closer. I just say parenthetically that this is the sugya of the Gemara, from which the Gemara asks, where do you measure from? And that becomes the sugya, which is very important in terms of determining the locale for death, because whether they measure from the navel, from the heart, and what exactly determines a kind of a signal, the sign of life, side issue. So the city which is closer takes the zikinim, are the ones who have to show up, and that's going to be significant in terms of figuring out what this is about. They're the ones who have to then bring this eglat bakar, and the terms for the eglat bakar, it has to be asher lo ubadba, asher lo mashcha be'ol. It has to be an animal, an egla, which had not done any work and which did not carry a yoke. It asks if that has any kind of reminiscences of somewhere else where you have an animal that's required to be brought, where there's no, it has not done any work, and it's lo mashcha be'ol, because that's going to be significant in terms of the parallels. That's part of how Chazal kind of draw meaning from this. Where else do you find that kind of thing? Paraduma is the example, and we're going to see if the Ramban makes reference to that. And
also on Yom Kippur,
we're going to see that that's actually becomes a significant literary, you know, kind of cross point for the Rishon to figure out what actually is this about, what's going on. So ve'aridu ziknei ha'ir ahia ta'eglal nachal etan. They have to bring the ziknei zikenim, have to bring down the egla to nachal etan. What that means, etan literally means, etan is chazak. What that means in terms of the nachal is subject to debate. We'll make reference to that a little bit again after we kind of just go through the pshat. Asher lo yaved bov lo yizareya ve'arfusha v'ta'eglal banachal. It has to be a location which is not worked and not planted. Again, question as to what that means and why. And there you do an arifa. Arifa, to be oreif, is to break the neck of the egla from behind. You don't do a normal shchita. The reason why you don't do a normal shchita is because since this is happening outside of the mikdash, it is again similar to the Seir HaMishtalech in that sense, and maybe a little part, it's like Paraduma too. It's like, it's not exactly a korban, but it has qualities of a korban. So what do you make of the fact that it's kind of like that, but not exactly like that, in terms of drawing significance? And now a different group come close, and those are the Bnei Levi, the Kohanim Bnei Levi, who are different from the Zekinim. Now it switches back. And they have to wash their hands in the water over this egla. And they're obligated to say, "Yadenu lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u." Our hands are not dirty. We are not responsible for spilling this blood, and our eyes did not see. What's glaringly lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u, and our eyes did not see what. Is there's no object to that, and that again becomes a didn't see. What didn't it see? What are we supposed to make of it? Kaperel Amcha Yisrael Asher Padita Hashem Bal Titein Dam Naki Bekerav Amcha Yisrael. And we ask for forgiveness for what again not clear. V'ni Kaperel Amadam, and this should bring them kapara. V'atat Va'er Hadam Naki Mikrebecha Ki Tasei Asher Bnei Hashem. And there's a prayer that the Dam Naki should be avenged and not told, we shouldn't be kind of held responsible. So this is kind of an unusual, it is Parah Aduma-like in terms of that technical point, but it's also Parah Aduma-like in that how does this work and what's the meaning of it, and it doesn't match anything. So Chazal and lots of Rishonim struggle with trying to figure out what it meant. In terms of the what is it part of it, there are a lot of sub things that can be pointed, that can be talked about. I just want to talk about two of them in the first kind of section of the source sheet. The first is, what does it mean that you have to bring him to Nachal Eitan, to a territory which is Asher lo yaved bo v'lo yizareya? What does it mean that it's a place that's not worked? So the Ramban quotes Rashi. I'm just kind of reading, going to read through the Ramban because he quotes, it's a good kind of collection of the different Rishonim. So Ramban says, El Nachal Eitan Kasher Shelo Ne'evad, Lashon Rashi. What does Asher Lo Yaved Bo V'lo Yizarea? What's the status? What does that land have to, it has to be, we kind of, when I read it without any grammar. What does Lo Yaved Bo V'lo Yizarea mean? Specifically the tense. What's the tense in the Rashi? Shalom ne'evad. Which is a past tense. Shalom ne'evad. And you have to take it, it's kind of, what's the logic, what does that connect to? It's almost, it's kind of like, if the animal is an animal that hasn't worked, so the land is supposed to be a land that also has not been worked. That kind of, that similar, that idea. Now, what the Ramban says, Rabboteinu Amru, that's not what Chazal said. Actually, Chazal did not interpret it that way. Chazal said, "Shehu ne'esar lachrosh lezra bo leolam." It's actually not that it has not been worked; it's that you're not allowed to work that going forward. And I would ask you, I'm going to finish the sentence here first, but just to kind of think about what this, what the difference is, and if you had to kind of fill that description with meaning, like what's the idea? What is it? What's it kind of symbolizing? But I'll just finish the sentence. Imkain hein azarot shazoreya o haoved bo over belav hazeh. What's the Ramban saying that is true about Chazal's interpretation that is not true in Rashi's interpretation? What does asher lo yaved bo v'lo yizareya mean according to Chazal?
That
not that it has not been worked. You may not work that land. And therefore, the Ramban concludes, if that's actually the pshat, then that means if you do work that land, you violated the pasuk that says, "Asher lo yaved bo v'lo yizareya." Now, v'atam asher yotzio to nachal etan ki lo yaved bo v'lo yizareya leolam. The reason why you have to bring it out to Nachal Etan, I'll make a point also. What does Nachal Etan mean? So, translating the words, it means a nachal is a river, a valley with water flowing through it. What does Eitan mean? Literally is translated as Eitan means chazak. So what is a nachal Eitan? Meaning, those are the words, those are the translation of the words. What does that mean? What is a nachal that is Eitan? So well, this is a machlok as we showed him too about how to understand this.
You can take it as a negative sense.
What does it mean? What does it mean to be...
That's very strong waters.
So the Rambam actually says that Nachal Eitan means it has to have a very strong current. Rambam is alone in saying that. He says that. Most Rishonim actually understand that Nachal Eitan means the soil is hard. Nachal Eitan...
Is a wadi.
Is a wadi. A wadi. Yeah. So the water comes and goes. I mean, yes, it's
potential.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes, like in a valley, the water, depending on the season, sometimes it's empty, sometimes it's not. So right. So, well, the flash flood part of it sounds Rambam like. The Radi part of it sounds like the rest of the Rishonim like. If you put that what everyone else says, which is the most common understanding, so what's the vibe that you get? Clearly, this space is supposed to be either it's never been worked and it is rock hard and you can't do anything with it, or you're not allowed to work it and it has to be the kind of place that you can't work because it should never be planted, it should never be. Now, there's actually a pretty, if you think about it in those terms, there's a symbolism I think that you can pull out of this. I mean, why should that be? It sounds like Hulk-like and bizarre, but actually it's like you think about it, you say, I get it. Actually, what's this about? What happened here? A life was cut short, you have no idea why. What do you actually do when you play out this idea of the kapara? I mean, there's a loss of growth, there's loss of potential life, there's loss of the impossibility of flourishing, so therefore where do you do this ceremony? It has to be, what's the idea of it being a place where you will not plant and you will not, or that has not been planted, or that you will not plant? Both of them kind of go in similar directions. There's a person who hasn't been able to flower, and so the symbolism of the proper of this spot is it has to be a place which has not been or will not flower. Why the difference between the back or the past or the future will be significant. We'll dig into that a little bit more. But that's kind of one drawing meaning out of the particulars of this. Of the ceremony. Now the Ramban says Vinyan Ha'arifa. So, what is this whole thing with the animal? What's it about? So Ramban actually quotes two, and then suggests his own. His first is Amar Bavram. First he quotes Ibn Ezra, and he says Shashem Tziva La'asot Kein Ala'ira Krova, that God commanded that we do this to the city, the closest city, by the closest city. Kiluleisha Su Aveira Kadomela. Had they not done some kind of aveira that was similar to this, lo nizdamein she'areg adam karov mehem. This never would have happened. I mean, Ibn Ezra is a rationalist, but he's actually being very, you know, ashkacha patis in a strong way. How are the citizens of the city supposed to understand what's going on here? Answer: if you find a dead body near the city, why does something like that happen? Because something is wrong in the city. And if something's wrong in the city, you need kapara. Now, it's important actually to note, what do you need kapara? If you actually think about what the Ibn Ezra is saying, what do you need? Well, I'll finish the sentence. He then says, "Umachshavot Hashem amkul ein keitz etzleinu." And God's thoughts, "Lo machshavotai machshavoteichem," we don't understand what it is, we just know that this must be true. So here's what I would ask you. According to Ibn Ezra, what's the kapara for?
It could be multiple things. I mean, it could be, you know, very simplistically that you didn't provide proper security in your neighborhood. It could be that there's something lacking in your community that you created a violent environment where somebody could be killed.
So those are two different things. Which one is more Ibn Ezra? Because Ibn Ezra's actually there's a little precision in what he's saying. You're right, both of those are true and quoted, but they're a little different from each other. Ibn Ezra says, why did somebody die? What am I supposed to draw as a conclusion from the fact that someone died here? That something is wrong amongst us. That is like a sign. Meaning, it's not necessarily this thing. Actually, it might be something else. But the kapar that I'm asking, that I'm supposed to be, according to this, what I'm asking for kapar for is not necessarily this. Just the fact that this happened here means that it's something I need to be asking kapar for. It might sound like a nuance, but it's a nuance. It actually makes a difference between this explanation and other explanations. To which, that's Ibn Ezra. Then he says...
He takes it back.
How? What do you mean?
He said, I don't understand that.
It's interesting. I didn't understand that to mean that he's taking it back. He's saying that we as citizens of this town who find this, the kind of... I take it like this. How do Jews think... When a tragedy happens in the community, what are you supposed to do when a tragedy happens in the community? You're supposed to be introspective and say, something's wrong, why did this happen here? And you have to do tshuva. I don't understand what I did. I might not know. As far as I know, I can't point to a sin that I did, but this must have happened for a reason. I have to do that. So I understood the machshavot Hashem are distant, meaning I don't know why it happened, but I have to do kapara. And I think we can, again, I feel like the nuance is significant, but I think we can kind of relate to that on some level. When tragedy, God forbid, strikes, part of what we're trained to do as Jewish people is to ask for kapara, to be mafashvish b'masaf, look inside. I don't know that I did this, but I'm sure that I did something, and that's why I'm doing it. That's the vibe that you get from the Ibn Ezra. Rambam goes in a very different direction. Aval Rav Amar Moran Vuchim. Rambam says Moran Vuchim. His explanation is ki ha'tam. What's the reason for this whole ritual? Ligalot al harotzeach. The reason why you do this is in order to uncover who's the murderer. What does this ritual have to do with uncovering the murderer? He says ulavair damo, and then to punish him. Most of the time, presumably, we're not talking about places where people are traveling far. Probably somebody, one of us, is responsible for this. If the Beis Din of the town, the rabbi is going to go out and start doing this whole measuring ceremony, and then the Zekanim are going to say, we didn't do, they're all going to have to come, and you know, there's going to be an inquiry, and the Zekanim are going to say, we didn't do anything, as far as we know, everything is fine. And she'inam yodim mi harag etzeh, they're going to say, we don't know who did it. She'yachkor ha'inyan, when they do the inquiry, they're going to determine, okay, we looked into it, we haven't found who did it, what are we supposed to do? Now we have to do this egla rufa process. V'yaviyu ha'egla, and then they do the process. Yirbu b'nei adam l'daber bo. You know what's going to happen when you do this bizarre ceremony, the Rambam says? The one thing that you're going to accomplish by having this kenim go out and check it, by having the kohanim then do a ritual, everybody's going to talk about it. And what you're going to accomplish by having everybody talking about it, right, you hear what the rabbis are doing, you hear what's going on at the edge of town, people are going to go out and see what's happening. So what's that going to, the talk, basically according to the Rambam, what you're doing is trying to generate a lot of discussion. When you generate a lot of discussion, the odds are that you're going to, some information is going to come through. And then you're going to figure out how it happened. Ulai galeh davar. Maybe through that, it's going to come to light what caused this to happen. And anybody who's like, oh yeah, I actually saw somebody strange, like walking out there following him, and I was wondering what that was. And then they're going to follow that lead, and then eventually they're going to figure out the thing. So yavo v'yagid v'parseim adavar v'yareg oyde beitin oyde melech. Then at least you'll be able to bring the person to justice. O goel adam v'chazei kainyan ki yot hamakom asher terafu egla lo yaved v'lo yizarei leolam. Now, and then through that he explains, he says, do you know why you're not supposed to work that place? Why does that place have to be left barren? What's the idea of it being nachal etan asher lo yaved bo v'lo yizarei? Because that is going to be, it's going to be a marked spot. This is the place where someone was found dead. And the hope is that through that, after the event is over, they don't find out, that place is still marked. That somehow when that place is marked, it's all going to be, it's going to generate the conversation that might allow us to find out what caused the murder. So that too can contribute to lo'olam yakiru bo ro'av yidabru bo. So these are two very different ways of thinking about this. According to the Rambam, what's the idea of the Egla Rufa?
To find the murder.
It's a strategy of the criminal investigation. I mean, it's as rational as you can imagine, right? It's something that sounds like carbon-like. It's trying to rationalize, trying to make it feel, right, correct. Now the Ramban really, the next line is just, this is a methodological Rambam kind of issue all the time. The Ramban will quote the Rambam and things like this, and he has one basic thing that happens over and over when he reads. He has a lot of things that he, right, Rambam argue all the time, but there's a recurring something. His basic problem, his problem with all of this is, you can just say it's like a stretch, which resonates, he has a more methodological problem, which is, So you tell me that God tells us to do it like this, and like this, and like this, and like that. Like, none of that really matters. Like, if I did it like that instead of like this, or like that, like if instead of, you know, leaving it empty, I decide to, you know, put a big poster, there, put a big sign over there, put flowers by that spot, that I could accomplish the same thing. So then it doesn't matter. It's just because you're making the... Now, the Rambam might say, and he does say this, when you think about the philosophy of mitzvah, the Rambam says all the time, yes, actually, the details of mitzvah sometimes don't matter, because there have to be some details. I don't know. Yes, you say, well, if I were doing the details, I would have done it like that. The Rambam would say, okay, you would have done it like that. The Torah says you do it like this. That doesn't take away from the fact that the idea of the mitzvah is what I'm telling you. For the Ramban, that's a knockout punch. It's like, that can't be. The God's telling you details, and there's no significance to it. So he says, this kind of ruse, this whole kind of, you know, the shenanigans have some purpose. According to what you're telling me, the actions, the specific actions, have no purpose on their own. So he doesn't buy that. We'll skip to the next line. He says, what do I think? Yesh bo tam kinyana korbanot. It is similar to korbanot. Which korbanot? Hanasim bachutz. The things that are korban-like in Chumash that are not done in the Beit HaMikdash. Sarei Mishaleach, Par Aduma. Ulefikach manu chachamim meglar rufa meklal chukim. Actually, that's why it's called a chok. So you sensed it in the language, or like from the beginning, like that's... but he says it's like korban-like, and specifically like those korbanot that actually have the same kind of... I'm not sure though what he can choose. And then what? So what is it? Like the Ibn Ezra says, I'm supposed to be... Ibn Ezra, he says what he says. Rambam is a rationalist. Ramban doesn't like the Rambam for his for those kinds of whatever. Then he says it must be it's a korban-like, but then he doesn't say what he thinks it's about. Well, what does he think it's about? So we all kind of assume that it's something like that. Like, you know, we maybe have some kind of responsibility, and so this is supposed to bring kapara. But, okay, I'm going to leave this kind of segment as is. What is it? That's like some kind of taste of what some of those pieces are. The second part, the thing I would like to focus on is, why is it, because I think it teaches us a little something, why is it here? And by here, I would ask you to just take a look for, try to skim what's happening in Parshat Shoftim. What's Parshat Shoftim about? So for our purposes, we want to focus on the second half. The first part of Parshat Shoftim basically focuses on the four leadership roles that exist in kind of the Jewish structure. It's kind of a separation of powers in Judaism. There are there are shoftim, there's a melech, there are kohanim, there are, you know, different roles that are played, and that's kind of what the first half of the parsha is about. Come the second half of the parsha, if you look at Perek Chaf talks about page 1038. This is what defines, you know, if you want to learn how do Jews wage war. So end of Parshat Shoftim was talks about how Jews wage war. If we kind of just skim by kind of looking at the chunks. So Pasuk Aleph until through Pasuk Tet in Perek Chaf. You go out to war, and they would gather the soldiers before coming and give them a pep talk and say, "This is a Milchemet Hashem. You got to go out and fight the battle and send." They'd send the people home who are not up for this for going out to war. Pasuk Yud, the next chunk, says, "Ki tikrav eli lachem alev krata eli l'shalom." If you go out to war, you have to try to attain peace first. The whole debate about when you try, and that describes who you kill and who you don't kill, what you do with the spoils of war, and that takes you to Pasuk Yud Chet. Pasuk Yud Tet, Ki Tatzril Ir Yamim Rabim L'Lachem Aleha, what does that talk about? Lo Tashchit Et Eitzah L'Ndoch Alav Garzen, Ki Menet Tochel V'Oto Lo Tichrot, Ki Adam Eitzah Sadeh. That's it, that's the source of Baal Tashchis. But what's it talking about? When you go to war, what you're not allowed to do when you're going out to war is raise the cities to the ground. Now I do that because wanton destruction is prohibited in the Torah. Right, so far all of this is talking about what's the kind of the ethics of battle in the Torah. And then Perkaf Aleph is next, and that's Egla Arufa. And then actually if you look at the beginning of Parashat Ki Teitzeh, just to kind of show that we're still on theme here. It says Ki Te'etzela Melchama Levecha, and that's the parsha of Eish Yifat Tor. So, what's this doing here? Why is that right smack in the middle? And how does that kind of fit in, whatever this description is? How does that fit into the kind of the broader and surrounding parashiyot? So I kind of backed into the question by trying to understand a couple of psukim in Shmuel Aleph and a Gemara in Shmuel Aleph, which I think through that he kind of came back into understanding what maybe is going on here. Famously, in Shmuel Aleph, God commands Shaul HaMelech that he should go battle Amalek. And when he goes to battle Amalek, he's told to destroy everybody. And and we know that Shaul, you know, he's told to do it. He doesn't do it, and that gets him into trouble, and David HaMelech is disappointed. Let's read the psukim, a couple of psukim. It says, the tzivui is, Ata lech v'kita at Amalek v'achramtim et kol shelo lo tachmol alav. You should have no chemla on them. Ve'imata me'isha arisha me'olo v'ad yonek mishor v'ad semi gamal v'ad chemor. You got to kill everything. Ve'ishama sha'ul et ha'am v'ayifkidem atla'im atayim el fragli. He tells them the commands. V'aseret be'alafim et ish yuda. V'yavo sha'ul at ir Amalek v'yarev v'nachal. And Shaul comes to Ir Amalek, Bayarev Banachal, which translates as Bayarev, he fought Banachal in the valley. The Gemara in Yuma says, Bayarev Banachal, Amarav Mani, Al Iske Nachal. What does it mean, Bayarev Banachal? It's very dramatic. I think it's like, I love this. This is like what Chazal do with psukim, and it's like so powerful. What does Vayar Banachal mean? Pipshat, that the battle took place in the valley. What did Chazal say? What's Vayar Banachal? Who was he fighting with? He was fighting with himself. What was he fighting about? Al Iske Nachal. He was wrestling over Iske Nachal, which is the topic of the Nachal, which is the Egla Arufa that's supposed to be brought in Nachal Eitan. B'sha Shemar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Shaul. At the time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Shaul, Lech V'kita Et Amalek, Amar, what did he say to himself? Uma Nefesh Achat Amra Torah Havei Egla Arufa. If when one life is lost, and we don't know what causes that to happen, the Torah has a special ritual and commandments to do under those circumstances. How am I supposed to just kill people just like that? And if a person did something, maybe some of the Amalekim are terrible. What the animals do? And if the adults sin, tani machatu. Yatza batkov amrlo. That's not your job. Your job is to do what God told you. Now, that's a fantastic, I think it was like a fantastic drasha, because, I mean, you'll stop and say, who? Okay, very nice. Nachal, Nachal Eitan, Vayarba Nachal, that's cute. What's it have to do with, what have to do with anything? I'm glad that those words match. How do they get all of that out of that? So I think actually what Chazal are pointing to is something really, if you're the king of Israel and you're going out to war, what do you do before you go out to war? You have to learn, how do you go out to war? What am I supposed to do as a king going out to war? God told me, but what do you do before you go out to war? You open Parsha Shoftim. What does Parsha Shoftim tell you? This is how you should gather your troops. This is what you should say to them. You should go out to war. This is what you should do with the spoil. And what do you do when you're reading the middle of the Parsha? That says Egla Rufa. So you can almost like imagine Shaul HaMelech reading this and that and doing what he's supposed to do, reads this Parsha and like, I don't get it. How can that possibly be the Tzivui? And then, right, he's told, that's not your, great, that's not your job. You should do it told. And in the end, he doesn't, and that's his downfall. But the Vayarev Banachal then becomes not he waged war with Amalek in the valley, but Vayar Banacha means he waged war with himself about what he understood the mitzvah of Egla Rufa to mean, and how do you apply it to this circumstance. Now that's, I thought, such a kind of great shot, so powerful. Then it's like, okay, then, but actually what does it mean? I mean, that's the wrong shot. So then what's the right shot? It is actually in the middle of the parsha of war. So I thought that, and I was like, well, what comes right after that? Yifat Torah. Actually, Yifat Torah is about, what does it tell you about Yifat Torah? You should not take her, you have to bring it back. What's the, you know, bring her back? Whatever the explanation of that mitzvah is, that's not for today, right? What's right before this? How to deal with the spoils, which basically means, where have you gotten to in the parsha of the war, parsha of this? It starts with before the war, then it talks about the war, and then it talks about after the war. Before the war is you should gather all your soldiers and you should tell them. During the war it says you should call for peace, then you should kill them, then destroy. And then after the war it's you can't raise the town to the ground, you can't do, right, this kind of set of things. Once you think about it that way, why is it here? What's it connected to, and why is it in this location? It's actually an instruction for after the war. I would submit as follows. When you're in the middle of war, what happens to you? I mean, that's the one place where it's a commandment to kill. You're not allowed to kill. And in war, it's maybe a mitzvah to kill. Right? In a certain sense, it's a mitzvah to kill. What happens to people when they kill? The value of life, it just changes. We've never killed anybody, and you can't imagine. And if we did, it would become somebody else. You know what the Parsha of Egla Rufa is and why it's here? The reason why it's here is to say, I understand that you're going out to war, but the war's going to end. And when the war ends, you're going to come back to your town. And when you come back to your town, you have to revert back to what you know is what the Torah is really valuing, which is every life is of infinite value, every person is Tzelem Elokim, and if there's a loss of life, that's a disaster for the community in the same way that it was before, and that's the return. So that's my second piece, which is, why is it here? Because it's actually describing the kind of the wrong way, or kind of the struggle through which we can then understand what it's actually really trying to say, which is after the war, how you manage kind of the ethics of it and put that into place. Okay. Third. So given that we talked a little bit about what the details are about, what this ritual is trying to do, why is it specifically here? The third thing is, what's the message it's trying to convey? So we kind of have an idea of the general message, but I'd like to point to a little bit of kind of an evolution. The Mishnah says, Mishnah in Sota says, V'chi al da'atenu alta, shezikne beitin shofchei damim heim, right? Remember that the skenim come and they say, Kapir lamcha Yisrael asher padita, you should bring us kapara, yadenu lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'inenu lo ra'u. It's not, our hands didn't do it, our eyes didn't see. So that's the pasuk. The Mishnah says, why are you saying that? Who would have thought such a thing? So, v'chiyal da'atenu al tash zikney beitin shofchei damim heim. Would we ever have thought such a thing? And so the Mishnah, I'm going to read to you the way that it's printed in our Mishnah, which is, el shalo, the bottom of the first side, el shalo bal yadenu uptarnuhu, below mazon is in parentheses, below reinu v'hinachnu, and below levaya is in parentheses. That's actually the way that it's written in our Vilna Shas, with the parentheses there. I'm going to ask you to turn the page for a second, and then we're going to go back to the first side. The Gemara, the Babli says, Tana Rabbanan, what's a brisa? And the brisa says, v'amru, yadenu lo shafchu et adam hazeh, v'edenu lo ra'u. V'chi alibenu alta shebitin shofchin tamim. Would we ever have thought that the Beit Din would do something like that? Ela lo bal yadenu p'tarnu below mezonot, below re'inu v'inachnu, below levaya. Like that. Now those who, if you compare the Babli and the Yerushalmi, and those who kind of track the kind of text from its original to the way that it's evolved, it's clear that the Mishnah actually did not have the parentheses, and the Bavli quotes a Braita that does and have those words, And then those then became kind of placed back into the Mishnah in parentheses. And so what our obligation is to try to understand what did the Mishnah say and what did the Braita say. You know, what I just wanted to try to show you is the Mishnah is written in a way in which it looks like the Mishnah and the Braita maybe have the same words, but the parentheses are still in the Mishnah because it allows you to see that there's some uncertainty about it. The research that was done on it shows that the Mishnah actually did not have those words and the Braisa does, which means that the Mishnah is saying one thing and the Braisa is saying another. If that's true, then our job is to identify what is the Mishnah saying and what's the Braisa saying. B'chiyal, let's read them separately. What would it mean without? B'chiyal datenu altash zikne beitin shofchei damim ela shalobal yadenu uptarnu v'lowi inuhu v'hinachnuhu. He did not come to our hands and we let him go. We did not see him and allow him leave him be. Who's this talking about?
Victim or the perpetrator.
Is it the victim or the alleged perpetrator? So the Yerushalmi does not have these words, and it's pretty clear that what's the Mishnah referring to in their understanding without these words? Take the words out. What's the Beit Din saying? We did not see this murderer and let him go. We didn't see this murderer and let him go. Basically, they're saying, so the Mishnah says, did we ever think that Ziknei Beit Din are murderers? Answer, no. But we do need them to say, we were not lax in our justice, and if had we seen him, we would have taken him and we would have imprisoned him, we would have killed him, we would have tried, we would have done whatever it is that we were supposed to do. According to that read, this is about, first of all, whom? The murderer. And what's the response, what's at stake here? And what's the Beit Din trying to absolve themselves of responsibility for not having an appropriate justice system? Now, the Mishnah later on in Maseches Sota says, Egla Rufa stopped. There was no Egla Rufa, just like it's in Maseches Sota. So it says, we don't do Sota, we don't do Egla Rufa, those things don't happen. So when they kind of track the change, they say, the Braisa on the second side actually changes, therefore, who it's talking about and actually who it's talking to. Because now read the second, and what's it saying? Meaning, now, who are we talking about here? Mezonot means food, and levaya means escort, right? Provide that he's like this has been escorted, he's kind of his safety has been provided for in his travels. So who is it talking about here?
The community.
So both of those are shifts, meaning it's not the Beit Din and the justice system with the murderer, it's actually the Beit Din as representatives of the community, meaning regarding the victim and what their kind of the degree to which the community is aware of just the people who they don't know, who they're trying to support in whichever way that they can. This last thing has now become kind of the strong meaning for us of what Egla Rufa is really about, which is, and I'll just contrast for a second, I'm going to run out of time here. Rasad Yagon says, Ani Omer, I'm actually going to skip Rasad Yagon. He actually focuses on, I'm just going to kind of say that he kind of stresses the shot of the Mishnah, which is really about having a proper justice system. Now I'm going to shift to a very different kind of application, which is the Bavli's application, which is not about having a proper justice system, but having a proper social support system that will be helpful to anybody who's around, anybody who's in town. I guess I'm going to skip a bit and just go as follows. This last idea, which is that Egla Arufa is actually about supporting with Livaya the people who are in town, and the people saying, we didn't see him and let him go. It's kind of emphasizing, it's kind of an interesting formulation even. We did not see him and let him go. Kind of sounds, it's a little guilt. It's a little bit guilt laden. It's like we didn't. I mean, meaning you didn't see him, and not give him food is also a problem. I mean, it's almost like that's not innocent. It's like you actually didn't see him, and therefore you didn't give him food. You didn't know that he was there, and therefore you did not provide him escort. Actually, that's why it happened. So I'm going to skip to the Rambam's at the end. The Rambam says, as Rambam in Hilchos Avil talks about the mitzvah of Ahavta Re'acha Kamocha, and it's in Hilchos Avil, and the Rambam says, mitzvah saseh shel divrehim levaker cholim lenachem avelim lotzi ames v'achnis hakala lelavot ho'orchim ulitasek b'chol tzorchei akvura l'sed al hakatef l'lech lefanav l'spor l'achbor l'kbor l'sameh chatan mekala. All these things are the examples of Ahavta Re'acha Kamocha. Bikur cholim, l'chem avelim, otzah ames, achnas hakala. That's all part of the mitzvah. Eilu hein gemilus chasadim shebegufo she'en lehem shi'ur. Even though they're all drabbanan, that's part of the kiyum v'havtorecha kamocha. Halacha bet. Schar halavaya meruba min akol v'u achok shechakeko Avraham Avinu v'derech chesed shenahagbo. Actually, the mitzvah of levaya that we're talking about here is even higher than the hachnasat orchim that we identify Avraham Avinu with. This is the ultimate manifestation, this idea of levaya. And the idea of levaya is what this Egla Arufa is basically about. Is it's a flaw to have a community in which you don't see the people who are there, the only people who are, we think of Hachnasas Orchim as inviting the people who we know over to our house. Mitzvah Hachnasas Orchim and Silvaya is inviting the people who we don't know over to our house. The mitzvah of Egla Arufa is the idea of recognizing that you're not paying attention to the people who you don't know, and therefore causing all kinds of destruction. There's a lot to say about that, but I'm out of time. I just want to end with two things which came into my inbox this morning, which are very striking in this regard. Marty Lukshin wrote a piece on Egla Arufa, and at the end of it, he actually quotes two manifestations that are very striking as a contemporary application of Egla Arufa. One is the Rabbanit Sohar in Israel a couple of years ago started a practice, a ritual practice, where a group of rabbis would go to a location where there's a traffic accident in Israel and somebody was killed and perform a quote-unquote verbal ritual of Egla Arufa. They said that's the idea of Egla Arufa. I mean, what? People are getting killed here. We're not paying attention. Everybody knows about driving in Israel and the disaster, and they would do Egla Arufa. I'm sorry to end on this kind of negative note, but he also quotes, I did not know this, that after 1982, after Sabra and Shatila massacre, when the Kahan Commission did whatever report, there were directly responsible Christian Druze people, and then the claim was that anyone else was indirectly involved and so not responsible. And the decision of the court was there is indirect responsibility on the part of whoever there was indirect responsibility for, based on what. And they quoted in the decision, Egla Arufa, that the reason why you're responsible is you might be, it's not just about being directly responsible for things that happen. Indirect responsibility, you're also responsible for things that happen. Those are kind of two practical applications of the way that's played out in recent times. We'll stop with that. Time for Maariv. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Thank you very much. Next week is Rabbi Adler.